Backseat Book Club, Book 8, Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson.
Sam.
We are the Backseat Producers, and this is Backseat Book Club.
We're talking about Snow
Live Crash. In-person edition, as opposed to live online edition, because it's just the two of us, because everyone else is lame, and Lena was moving, and our last-minute super helpful stand-up guy, is his microphone died.
It's okay, David, we still love you.
You're awesome, David, thank you for giving me an essay that's going in the... That we're going to do a comment special for that one. Mostly so I can pretend we still have comment specials. Like, I've always had an open share policy on this. Like, anyone who really wants in can join. But there are 100 people who download this in the first week. 40 people on the Goodreads group for sure. I'm looking for another permanent guest host so shit like this don't happen anymore. That would come with a full voting share in how the books go. Other business-wise, it is next month is South of the Border, West of the Sun.
Except that on the Goodreads page, it'll tell you it is American Gods.
Yeah, the Goodreads scheduling is completely borked, and that's my fault. So I'm going to try and fix that.
So, yes, it is apparently South of the Border, West of the Sun.
By Haruki Murakami.
The greatest living author that ever lived.
I don't think that qualification quite works the way you think it does.
I'm drunk.
You've had, like, half.
And I'm a lightweight.
For the record, the whiskey is out, because it's just the two of us. So we're sitting at our table in our old man sweaters with
I'm
the whiskey.
I'm not an old man.
That is an old man sweater.
It's an old lady sweater, because it is topazy and, like, not ash gray, like regular old man sweaters.
It looks very Kowochin, which might make it a hipster sweater. I don't think it's actually Kowochin, though, so we're okay.
Stop picking on my sweater.
After that, American Gods, and then after that, Redemption and Indigo.
When did we decide Redemption and Indigo?
Because I owe you a favor, Sam.
So, Redemption and Indigo by Karen Lord. Magic realism. And the Caribbean. Because we need more of that.
Oh,
that's
that mean...
not in the form of The Tempest.
And that means Sam gets to do her post-colonial rant.
It's a big one.
Yay! All right, so that's our schedule for the next little while.
I actually had that rant today, by the way, because a kid's reading The Tempest for school, and he looked at me and said, Miss, this is the hardest Shakespeare play ever. I'm like, no, it's not.
Okay, but yes, if you do want to join us as a full-time host...
or a guest host.
Email me. That's foulsorceress@gmail.com. I'll include a link-ish. I'll make sure it's written out. I don't need too much more spam. Yes.
So, we're talking about Snow Crash tonight, and I thought, instead of just jumping right into the plot, I'm going to give you guys a quote. Think about it for a few minutes. It says, did you win your sword fight? Of course I won the fucking sword fight, Hero says. I'm the greatest sword fighter in the world. And you wrote that in the software. Yeah, that too, Hero says.
So, this was written in 1993, well, published in 1993 by Neal Stephenson. And it deals with a hero protagonist, last free hacker in the metaverse, world's greatest swordsman, music producer, librarian for the Library of Congress.
All self-proclaimed.
Well,
mostly self-proclaimed.
Mostly self-proclaimed. But he ends up stumbling upon a conspiracy that via the television, the internet, and computers, a crazy evangelical Christian, and Sumerian neurolinguistics is going to brainwash the world with the help of a package courier who is 15 years old. He saves the world.
And delivers pizza.
This is after losing his job delivering pizza.
Because, you know, pizza delivery men, or delivery boys in general, are usually the hope of the universe, if that's what Futurama tells us.
This is what Futurama tells us.
Makes me wonder if Futurama took some of its inspiration from this.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure they've directly referenced Snow Crash.
I figured as much.
All right, so your high-level thoughts, Sam.
I have really mixed feelings about this book, Scott. And the reason I have mixed feelings is because in terms of prose, it's kind of a fucking mess.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it's entirely done on purpose, but it is an uncomfortable read for that reason. Yes, the man put half of his dissertation in here.
Yes.
And it's really noticeable, really detracting, mm-hmm. and it made me very angry.
Okay.
Mostly because in the sense that every time he put in, you know, instances where he would go into huge detail about certain things that he was ranting about in that moment, it was really detracting to the actual plot at hand. On one hand, yes, it's the whole, there are hackers, and then there are evangelicals, and the evangelicals are trying to, you know, use their powers to brainwash. I get that. At the same time, he goes on for pages and pages of this, and it almost feels at times like it's going nowhere. And I don't know if that's his intention to brainwash me as the reader, or for me to take the book and throw it across the wall, which I did exactly one time.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I will say, I absolutely adored the introduction of this book, and I absolutely adored the ending. And I think it's because the ending, the last 40 pages or so, are written quite differently from the middle of the text, and the beginning is also very different from the text. That I enjoyed because it was action-packed. The descriptions were a lot more subtle, even, in spots. And one thing I appreciate, especially with the introduction, is just sort of how the narration is done with a more... I'm trying to think of how to describe it, because the prose is very active, it's very aggressive in the beginning. Slow, but it has a level of aggression to it, and the ending follows suit. So where the book lost me was kind of in the middle, you know, once the whole evangelical nonsense started, and I was kind of going, hero, grow some balls, and when you do get some, come back to the story, because we need you, you're our only hope, and fix this mess of a plot. Maybe for me it's also just the fact that I'm not a philosophical person, and I know that Stevenson, I think, in a way is trying to get us to think a little bit deeper about technology and, you know, how we deal with the universe around us, especially one that is almost entirely online now. And that's impressive for around 1983.
Yeah.
I have to give him the credit where credit's due. This novel really does act like it's beyond its time.
This one truly is, especially when you consider a lot of the attitudes of sort of his predecessors in the cyberpunk subgenre. Yeah, this is the real punk literary subgenre. My high-level impressions are, yeah, there are definitely bits where you, basically anytime Hiro talks to the librarian, you kind of just...
I tuned out.
You have to force your way through or just skip to the next page break.
I tuned out. I mean, and I love librarians in texts. This one I did not, because he was the snoozeworthy librarian.
Yeah.
He was not a fun librarian like, you know, our precious archivist books.
Yes. Yeah. But it's really a game changer for the genre. Like, if you've listened to the companion piece to this, it is the pivot point between cyberpunk and post-cyberpunk. And you can tell that in the beginning, because at this point, cyberpunk had pretty much established itself and had a slew of really crappy imitators.
Poor William Gibson.
Poor William Gibson. And so that first chapter is intentionally mocking that. Like, it is, like, ever since Johnny Mnemonic came out, every other cyberpunk story is about a hard-ass cyborg courier. And that's how the opening plays, until you find out he's just delivering pizza. And then, from there, you spread out into the setting, which is really where this book shines more than anything else.
I can agree with
that. It is a messed up, afraid look. He looked at America of the early 90s, took the things he was afraid of, and made that America of the year 2000.
Well, it seems like he also dialed it up enough to make it like, even more like his worst fear.
Like, this is his worst fears realized, and the setting is amazing for it, where you have corporation, like, the suburb homeowners associations now have more power than the state, and, you know, prisons have stupid themes that private security takes you to.
See, when I think of the homeowners association, I think of chickens on my lawn and why I can't burn leaves.
Oh, well, see, here's the thing, is if you kept chickens or burned leaves in any of the burb claves here, they'd send you to jail.
Hey, to Funtime Jail.
Or possibly tattoo you.
So it's not like a fungin.
Not like a fungin, no.
Fungin. I'm immature. Okay.
But more of my high-level thoughts. I think, obviously, like, outside of YT and Hero, I don't think the characters have a lot to pop. Except maybe Uncle Enzo.
Enzo is... He just reminds me of, like, a horrid Italian stereotype, and I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
That is his character. At least he's entertaining for it. I am 100% with Scott. The only characters that shine in this story are the only two that he gives any actual depth to, YT and Hero. Every other character is a hollow shell of nothingness. They don't contribute anything to the story, nor do they add to it.
Like, that, they're just vehicles for the plot.
They're plot vehicles, and the novel for me suffered because of that. I'm very much a character person when I read a book.
And this is sort of idea-minded science fiction.
Yeah, so for me, this was already kind of a...
Which is why it has, you know, someone's dissertation in the middle of it, and why you have a lot of time... Like, it does stop to just... It does kind of stop to have just...
A conversation with you.
Digressions about the setting. Like, you don't really need to know what makes the rat things go, but then it's kind of sweet.
Let's just say... I guess for me personally, I'm not that kind of reader. I don't really like when somebody stops me in the middle of the story to say, hey, and then there's this. Because then I go, one, do I care about this? And two, if you're boring me to tears, stop now because I'm going to put your book away.
So
I powered through this, though, because you know what? At the same time, a part of me wanted to see where it could go. And I think that's why the middle for me was just so damn hard, because it would be stop and go, stop and go, stop and go. And I don't like that in a book at all.
Yeah. But I guess getting more into characters, I actually want to start with YT, because we've already said a little bit about Hero with your quote, but I think YT might actually be the actual hero slash protagonist of this story. I mean, she has as much impact, if not maybe more, because she has a definite arc to the story, and she is a skateboard courier in the Southern California sprawl that all cyberpunk should take place in, apparently. But
because we can't have Great White North cyberpunk, clearly.
There is no good Canadian cyberpunk. I am sorry, Kari Doctorow.
He tries so hard.
Well, even he sets his cyberpunk in San Francisco or London. So there you go. But mm-hmm. She's just a teenager. At the start of it, like, she has this job that she does illicitly, less for the money and more just because
it's fun.
She enjoys having a magnetic harpoon magnetic harpooning herself to cars and being dragged around on a skateboard at hundreds of miles an hour, which sounds awesome.
It is awesome.
And then she actually kind of gets all rolled up in this crazy stuff and never really has a full idea of what's going on, but
she
powers through, like, she rolls with it and manages to power through and really actually get a lot done to save the world.
I think she does more than Hero does.
More than, like, Hero knows everything, and he has, you know, a sword fight on motorcycles on the internet with
everybody.
A sociopath.
Because, you know, that's
but
pretty awesome.
But she's the one that really gets things moving.
It's not just that, I think she puts more on the line than he does in a lot of cases.
Like,
because
she also has more to lose because, you know, her mom is a coder for what's left of the U.S. government.
Yeah. And because of that, it makes it everything a little bit more tricky for her. She has more to lose and more to basically put back together if everything gets screwed up in the end.
Yeah.
And you feel sorry for her. just because of that. Like, she puts out such a good attitude towards the situation. She knows that she doesn't have a real choice in the matter, so she might as well just, you know, suck it up and deal with it. And she does. Like, I actually think she's a better character than Hiro just because she shows strength, but she shows it in very subtle ways. It's not brute force strength in a lot of cases, which I think is Hiro's mentality for a lot of things, which is, I have cyber swords.
Like,
Hiro's a geek. Like,
Hiro's a geek and a geek's fantasy. Like, yeah. I think everyone wants to be, you know, the super hacker swordsman guy.
At the same time, you know, I feel like Hiro treats a lot of, in terms of the cyber aspect, I think he treats a lot of it like it's kind of a joke at times. Like, especially at the beginning, more so, until he starts to realize how serious everything is. He definitely kind of just goes, you know, I'm the best at this. I can do this. And he's too damn cocky for his own good. And I love when he gets his ass handed to him.
Yeah.
For him to finally have some growth. Because his problem is, it takes him a while to get some growth in the actual story, whereas YT, it's all gradual. Everything with her moves at a steady pace, whereas I found with Hiro, it definitely took a lot longer for me to say, you know what? I'm cool with you. I'm okay with what you're doing. Whereas YT, I was very much invested in what she was doing.
Yeah, and even then, Hiro kind of endears himself just with some snappy one-liners and just he's having fun with what's going on around him.
But doesn't really see the seriousness right away.
Like, he doesn't see the seriousness of anything. But, and that even shows in his character, like, you know, he coded the version of the internet everyone uses, which is, you know, kind of like Second Life on steroids. Or I guess maybe a little more like the Oasis from
Ready Player One, definitely.
Ready Player One. We're name check. Go back to that episode.
But actually, that's a very good comparison.
But again, let me finish this point. He created this. He could have, you know, the run of anywhere, you know, leading up a department. And what's he doing? Oh, you know, he produces a couple local rappers. He indexes articles for Wikipedia. Like, this is all he does. Like, he's kind of a loser at the same time as being super cool.
But isn't that kind of like a trope in cyberpunk, that the main character has to kind of be a loser in order to become a hero?
Well, cyberpunk is it takes its cues, especially for protagonists from noir. So the main character has to be an outsider. Not necessarily a loser, although definitely more often than not from the have-not side of the equation.
So we're not looking at, like, the Philip Marlowe-style noir, you know, like a Raymond Chandler here. Because if it's taking its cues from that, I mean, if you look at someone like Philip Marlowe, he's not entirely an outsider. He's very crystal clear about the world around him.
Yeah, well, no, not necessarily like an outsider.
Or you mean more like a Sam Spade, where that's an outcast for sure.
Not necessarily like someone who is outside the rule, places himself outside society and the rules, not necessarily someone who has been forced out.
Okay, well,
it's a very Ubermensch sort of mentality.
Okay, I only ask because I've read more classic mystery than I have cyberpunk, so
yeah.
For me, I understand the tropes of noir, but I find that for me, cyberpunk's a little bit of a trickier mistress because that sounded dirty. I feel like it borrows from more than just noir, based on what I've read here.
Yeah, well, again, this is the thing, is this is a turning point in cyberpunk. I find, like, again, it's the pivot between this and post-cyberpunk. So the characters are a bit different than you get from, than Count Zero, or Case, or Molly, or Rydell, even.
I've only read Neuromancer, it's the only other cyberpunk experience I've had, so...
Well, since we've both read it, we can actually compare and contrast. If we were smarter and maybe less interested in having in democracy, we would have done Neuromancer first and come to Snow Crash a few months later.
We didn't think about that, so boo-hoo.
But, like, if I were to plan a cyberpunk-themed podcast, that is how I would go about it. But we take the cards we're drawn. Other characters, we mentioned Uncle Enzo.
To be honest, I don't remember any of the names of the other characters other than Enzo, YT, and Though there is a stupid character that has the number 8 in their name, and I thought they were just really stupid.
Oh, the rapper.
The rapper. He was stupid.
Yeah.
Your name is stupid. You have an 8 in the middle of it.
Well,
what is your name? 8? Come on, dude.
Well, I think the...
I know what the point of it was, but to me it's just... I don't know what to say. Like, how do I say his name?
Yeah, there are a lot of people who get referred to by, like, nicknames. Or names of choice is a recurring theme, actually.
YT. Name is actually yours truly.
Like, it's people choose their own name. So you have DeFivid, which...
Is that how you say it?
No, it's... You actually say it David because it's a play on five is V. Yeah.
Neal Stephenson, I still hate you for that. just in case you ever hear this, I do hate you for it.
But, there's Uncle Enzo, who is a mob boss who runs a pizza franchise. Because the mafia would run a pizza franchise in a world where law enforcement really doesn't matter beyond the borders of condo development.
I was gonna say, and Neal Stephen didn't even come up with this first. The Simpsons did. So, yeah!
Simpsons did it.
Simpsons did it. I mean, mind you, let's face it, anytime the mafia comes up, the Italian mafia in particular, not the other kinds, I mean, usually we have every Italian stereotype possible thrown in there, because every mobster likes pizza. Every mobster likes to cut somebody's fingers off. Every mobster, you know, loves their mother. Every mobster gets shot like Sonny in The Godfather.
Enzo has a few more dimensions in that, you know, he does take a shine to YT for finishing a delivery for Hiro for no real reason, thus saving Hiro his car, well, not his car, but at least his life, because, of course, when the mafia runs a pizza franchise in a world without laws, if it's late by more than 30 minutes, you can shoot the driver and take his car.
Some good rules to live by.
Good rules to live by. So he takes a shine to her and helps her out, which gets her out of a sticky situation later. But even then, he does jump into action once he gets a better feel for what's going on. And again, he also has not just the mafia stereotypes, but the ex-Vietnam guy stereotypes to play with.
Which I thought was really weird.
Well,
like, it works, and it grew on me when I started to figure that out, but I was kind of like, when I think of Vietnam veterans, I think of Uncle Cy Robertson from Duck Dynasty. Because, really, that's what you tell fourth graders. You went to Da Nang. So how about that Nam? Sorry, for me, I guess with Enzo, and I think what I liked about Enzo just, I guess, is all the stereotypes. Enzo really does function on the mentality of an eye for an eye, which I love. Because that is one of the few Italian mafia stereotypes I'm actually okay with. As someone who is Italian and whose father used to tell people he might be involved with the mob.
Also, Sam is a big believer in the Chicago way, so don't mess with her. Do not mess with her. She will put one of your guys in the morgue.
Since when? I'm not the one who does the cinder block? Cinder block to the feet? I don't do that?
No. Okay. I guess the other characters, again, Juanita's just kind of a plot device. Bob Reif is a plot device. But the only other big presence in the book is Raven.
Oh, yes. Raven. Who's like...
Who is a mutant and a sociopath.
He's a mutant sociopath who likes sexy times through the idea of lacerations, which is kind of... I guess that's okay.
Well, everything about him is really squicky.
But you know what? Now that you mention Raven, I forgot about Raven. He's kind of intriguing, actually, because he's a little squicky, because everything makes you uncomfortable. Like, when Raven talks to YT, he almost sounds like a rapist.
Except she's consenting because she thinks it's cool.
No, but I mean in the sense that, like, it's the way that he talks to her, not the consension part. Yeah. That I don't care about, because that makes, you know, she consented, whatever. But it's the way that he is creepy on purpose, because that's her thing.
Yeah.
She doesn't mind when a guy talks to her like a rapist. That made me really uncomfortable, but at the same time, I knew what Stevenson was doing with it, with that character, and it makes perfect sense because of how that character is structured. Their relationship is actually kind of intriguing, though, because, you know, Raven's really squicky. He's a mutant. You know, he is pretty sure that the world wants him destroyed. But he has no problem saying, I could destroy the world back.
Like, this is a man who just hangs out with a nuke.
Because he can.
And, you know, he is straight up, I think, because at this point, 1992, you had, you know, four major cyberpunk tabletop role-playing games out. Raven is someone's Shadowrun character.
He may have been mine.
Like, that sort of attitude is very much almost a comment, like, that on other cyberpunk works. Not necessarily the role-playing, but other lesser authors in it, where it's like, these are the characters you want us to root for. I'm going to make him the villain because bad protagonists make awesome villains. And so he's intriguing, but utterly detestable.
Like, oh, he's a sickening person.
Like,
he cuddles nukes.
Like, it's an interesting thing to see where you have Juanita, who is almost makes sense. You can almost make sense of her, almost sympathize with her motivations for wanting to mess with everyone's heads. Bob Reif, you know, he's a pawn, but...
He's a tool.
And then you have Raven, who is just utterly despicable, but you can't look away.
Raven's that character that you see sometimes in fantasy literature who wants to be the big bad wolf. Except in actuality, he really is the big bad wolf. And he's terrifying.
He is terrifying, and it leads me to my personal favorite quote of the book, and it will probably be in the show notes, but it is, until a man is 25, he believes he could be the baddest motherfucker on the face of the earth. You know, just the right set of circumstances, a few years in a monastery, the mob taking out my family, just the right motivation. Hero doesn't have that pretension. He's already met the baddest motherfucker on the face of the earth. And that's liberating. There's no pressure anymore.
No, there really isn't.
And that's when the hero kind of jumps in and is just like, yes, I am going to grab the high-tech Gatling gun. I am going to have a sword fight on motorcycles on the internet.
And I am going to punish you.
And he's going to take everything down. And at the same time, nothing's really different. Because that's noir, and that's cyberpunk.
That's the wonderful thing about the noir genre. Scott's 100% right. A lot of the times, you'll have a resolution, but it never feels like the world is changed for the better, or for the worse sometimes even.
Yeah.
It's like... The world just is what it is. And I know for a lot of readers, that can be incredibly frustrating because, you know, you want real closure. Snow Crash really doesn't have that. In a sense.
Yeah.
Which is
Forget why... it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
But that's why I think I like the ending so much. I'm somebody who grew up reading a lot of Raymond Chandler and a lot of... mostly Chandler, actually. And I did read a lot of Dashiell Hammett as well. And they were notorious for these endings where it would just trail off.
Like, if you want a really great noir ending, The Big Lebowski.
Yes. Yeah.
He doesn't even get a new rug.
And you can definitely see that Stevenson, he knows his stuff in this sense, because there's actually no way for this novel to end.
Yeah.
You know, if you kill Raven, so what? It just means another badass motherfucker under the age of 25 might come out and start the war all over again. You know, it really shows that there's no real villain in this world. The only true villain is, in fact, yourself.
Yeah.
Which is the ultimate lesson I feel like Hero learns. I mean, in a sense, he learns it, but he also kind of goes, eh.
Eh. Like, he learns it, and then he doesn't know what to make of it. So he just, you know, puts his swords away and calls it a day.
Pretty much.
I mean, YT, like, that's the great ending, is YT just calls her mom for a ride home. Like, that's all you can do.
Well, at that point, I think, like, I look at YT, and I think that for her, there's just an exhaustion to everything she's gone through, whereas... Hero, I don't get that same kind of feeling. Hero just, I think he just accepts it for what it is, but I don't think he even understands in some cases that, you know, killing the villain doesn't necessarily mean the villain is truly ever gone. You learn the lesson, but you kind of don't do anything with it.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I, like I said, I think that'd be frustrating for some readers, but again, when you grow up reading noir and, you know, classic mystery novels, a lot of them just end with this logic that usually the detective's tired, the detective's done, detective needs a big sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking.
I've actually got some notes and discussion points from a couple of places, and I'm kind of interested because the book has quite a range of thematic things, but I think it does some good stuff with gender roles and masculinity.
Yeah, hero's the woman in the story.
Like, again, we've kind of touched on that so far, but you wanted to make a comparison to Ready Player One.
Well, I know, I was just going to say, I mean, I thought it was interesting that you suggested that the world that, you know, Hero and YT inhabit is very similar to that of the Oasis, and I agree with that, only because the Oasis is such it's a lonely place. And this world comes across equally empty, equally lonely. There's stuff going on in it, but it just doesn't have, like, a vibrancy, you know, when you think of, like, a metropolis.
Yeah.
The world's dying. And the Oasis kind of gave me the same feeling. Like, the difference with the Oasis was that there was color. There was vibrancy because it was like a video game. But at the same time, you have a bunch of people playing together but never really interacting and never really speaking. And I feel like you get the same sort of feeling here. I think when people interact with each other, it's more to show who's got the bigger kahunas as opposed to having a meaningful discussion.
And that's the thing. Like, the first thing Hiro does when he walks into the bar is he doesn't get into a chat about, you know, rap music. No, he gets into a sword fight with some, you know, some salaryman, some wage slave in Tokyo, and just wastes him because he wrote the code.
Why can't do it?
No reason why he can't do it. And I think, and at the same time,
for me, Snow Crash is it's going to be an interesting contrast to going into South of the Border, West of the Sun. Neal Stephenson really offers this theme of loneliness just in the atmosphere of the world. When we get to South of the Border, West of the Sun, Haruki Murakami's biggest theme in all of his novels is isolation. What does it mean to be an observer and not a contributor? And I feel like in this story, all the characters have to sort of build to a contributing status. Because at first they don't really want to contribute. Hiro contributes through writing programs and whatnot, but he does it for himself. He doesn't do it for other people. Right? And I feel like that doesn't make him an actual active participant. I think, you know,
well, even he's introduced delivering pizza.
That alone tells you right there.
There you go.
I feel like,
and again, YT's a courier.
Again, you don't have to speak to anybody.
You're not really working. You're working for someone else.
I feel like this is a very strange.
You
theme.
Just convey things for others.
I feel like it's a strange theme that runs through this book club, actually, just in terms of the types of protagonists we seem to encounter. We don't really have a lot of social butterflies.
Well, it's interesting how a bunch of people on the internet might not have social butterflies. You know what, let's see if we can, you know what, we'll see. Maybe Perks of the Being a Wallflower ends up on the list.
That's not a good example. That's another book of someone being a lonely observer and basically screaming, I can be social, maybe. You wouldn't read it anyway, so.
Okay, that's fair. But
I'm calling you out on it, you wouldn't read it.
Okay.
And it's one of my favorite books, and that alone would make you not want to read it.
All right, but something I think a lot of people talk about in this book is that it was... People like to say Neal Stephen invented things because they show up in this book, or predicted things, like, you know, the avatars on the internet. He predicted Second Life. He predicted, you know, the internet, a lot of things about the internet now. And sure, the book relies heavily on the idea, a very new idea at the time, of memetics, but memetics didn't really pan out the way the people who were pioneering it really thought it would. But again, I think they're kind of putting the cart, in terms of things he predicted, I think they're putting the cart before the horse. I think a lot of computer programmers read this and were like, yeah, we should come up with a software that allows you to display an image next to your posts.
Because, you know, why not?
Because why not?
Everybody wants a happy winking smiley face.
Yeah, or, you know, my, whatever I'm going with, the displacer moose on Twitter.
Grrr.
Arg. And I think there's a lot of stuff where it's just like, no, people thought that was cool, and then they went and did it. Like, there's a famous story from a former Apple software designer who was watching an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and Data asked his computer to play Mozart for him. And then he went to work the next day and invented QuickTime.
Pretty impressive.
Or at least started it, but that's the idea, is that there's a certain point where science fiction stops predicting things and just becomes the primary inspiration for it. And this is definitely the case with this book. Like, a lot of internet culture grew out of this. But I guess we could talk a little bit about comparing this to Neuromancer.
I'm trying to remember Neuromancer, but my booze is making it tricky.
Okay.
But we can try.
But, okay. So the thing about Neuromancer is... The big difference is very structural. Like, Neuromancer is a heist novel.
It's a heist novel, and it's also written in such a way where it is comprehensible by comparison in some cases.
Well, here's the thing. I was actually talking to someone else who had just taken... This was someone I kind of just started shouting at in the middle of a bookstore. Not really. I was joining him and shouting at his contemporaries in a U of T sci-fi book class, sci-fi fiction class. And apparently his tutorial group seemed to think that Neuromancer, every third word had been left out, whereas this was much more comprehensible because it actually took the time to explain anything. Now, Neal Stephenson has big ideas and isn't afraid to explain them to you, but Neuromancer, style-wise, is not a book about the future the way... earlier science fiction is. Neuromancer is just a book from the future.
It's a book from the future with heist ideas. It's a heist story.
It's a heist story, but it's told entirely from the perspective of someone who is very familiar with how Chiba and hacking and space stations would work.
And you have to kind of trust in the narration of Neuromancer. This is the thing, is Gibson kind of forces you to kind of trust into everything that the protagonist tells us in the story. Whereas I found with Snow Crash, that was not the case. Gibson wants you to trust in what is happening because there's almost like a greater good at stake.
Well, he just says, this is what's going on. These are my characters. And this is where they're going.
And this is what they're doing, so fuck off.
And then, not necessarily so fuck off, but it's like, the world they inhabit is just the world they inhabit. The ideas will come out of that, whereas Stevenson's story is about the ideas first, always.
I was going to say, definitely this you have to read a little bit more into.
And this is kind of true of a lot of Stevenson's other stuff.
See, I've only read this, so I can't help you guys here.
Well, I'm going to do a little piece later about the first further reading episode about Diamond Age, which is...
the one I want to read and that we should have done instead of this one.
I'm sorry.
That's okay, I'm joking.
Sam would actually probably like Diamond Age a lot more. And I think this is only Stevenson's second novel,
Third.
And I think maybe seeing him more experienced does change some things.
Perhaps. That usually is what happens to most authors. They either grow or they deteriorate. You tell me. Because
quite the statement there, Sam. People either grow or deteriorate.
I mean in the sense of writing abilities and ideas.
Yeah.
Right?
There is no stability in authordom.
No, there really isn't. I mean, one minute you can absolutely love what an author does, and the next minute you go, what the shit was this? What were you thinking? Die in a fire. I've done that a few times, actually.
This may be related to editors.
Usually.
I think that has some more to do with editors. You either see the author grow beyond the need of editors, or an author get so popular that editors are afraid to touch anything, and then...
So, like, Robert Jordan, who really did need an editor.
Robert Jordan had a lot of issues beyond just an editor. I think I'm more in sort of the Laura Hamilton or Stephen King sort of vibe mode. Or J.K. Rowling.
Let's say where people were that afraid of them because they were more a god than a human being in terms of a writer.
Or at least make the company a lot of money so we have to keep them happy, Mr. Junior Editor.
Stephen King's an asshole.
Oh, he is.
I mean, and that's why we love him.
And that's why we love him.
Because if he wasn't an asshole, we wouldn't get such classes as Cell and, you know...
Under the Dome.
I actually want to read Under the Dome. I have it.
Yeah.
Okay, we're getting off topic.
We are far afield.
I do think that Neal Stephenson is a very intelligent man. And I think that his readership appreciates somewhat the directions that he goes in his novels. Because he's not afraid to bring up topics that are important to him and go into massive detail about it.
See also the entire Baroque cycle. I know a great deal more about the early Enlightenment scientific pursuits than I really ever needed.
Well, there's no reason for that book to be almost 1,000 pages, I'm sorry.
And it's just the first part of a trilogy.
Which all the other books are 1,000 pages.
I'm really holding back on picking up the second book.
Meanwhile, I bought them on Kindle for 99 cents. A different Neal Stephenson book, which is also 1,000 pages.
Neal Stephenson
somehow went from 300-page books to 1,000-page books.
He. There's a point where he just jumps, and it's like, nope, we don't want but, to. Just 1,000 pages, no matter what.
Just to get back on my point, though, I feel for me personally that I think I would have appreciated Snow Crash more if I had been in the mindset of, I give a fuck about your dissertation.
Yeah.
And that's where, for me, like, if I was to rate this novel 5 stars being the best and 1 star being the worst, it would probably get a 2.5 from me. And that's only because, you know, I see the effort. I think the world is absolutely fabulous. I think the two main characters are intriguing, YT more so than Hiro. Hiro I wanted to punch a couple times because I think he's a little bit of a whiny bitch. Mm-hmm. And I want to obviously give the points for really awesome opening and really awesome ending. That middle, if that middle had been something I gave a rat's ass about, easily a 5-star novel. Easily!
Yeah.
But for me, the amount of dragging that that middle section does for me, and how boring that prose reads, is not enough to keep me engaged. And that's where my frustration lies with this novel. I love the world, I love the atmosphere, I love the aesthetics. Just give me some prose to give a crap about.
And again, I think if I'm getting into final thoughts, is I'm a little higher than you in the 3.5, 3.25 range. But I'm a huge fan of cyberpunk, and I've sort of seeing what has come after and what has come before, appreciate sort of just how much influence it has had on the genre.
And you know what? If I knew more about cyberpunk, I think I might have been in the same camp as you. Unfortunately for me, I'm still a little new to the genre and understanding a lot of its tropes. Now, if we were talking about Japanese surrealism,
which we will next month,
I'm a freaking pro.
See, this podcast may shift if you know, things don't go so well with this new host, which you should totally volunteer for. You want to stop me or just to encourage my power grab, I will eventually turn this into the all cyberpunk show for a year.
Please don't. I mean, I don't really want the job of guest host, but please don't do that to us. We enjoy being a multi-genre show. At some point, we really need to get out of the science fiction and fantasy and do something that's a little bit, you know, out there. Maybe, you know, a nice contemporary novel. How's about, you know, those things called mystery novels? Hell, I think Scott should read a Harlequin romance.
We will not do a Harlequin romance.
No, we won't do a Harlequin romance.
But yes, we should probably do... I may just use my powers to get some, not even if not a mystery, some crime fiction or some spy stuff.
Oh, honey, I got plenty.
I know. I'm almost tempted to just sort of like, you know, who wrote Hugh Laurie?
Wrote a spy novel.
Wrote a spy novel.
It's actually pretty cheeky.
It's pretty fun. We should all read that. You know what? After Redemption in Indigo.
Gunseller?
The Gunseller by Hugh Laurie. This is what happens when no one else shows up to record. I just start declaring things.
Which is not a good thing, but we're okay with this tonight.
Sam's happy with my choices.
I'm okay because, for me, Redemption and Indigo, for an example, is not a stereotypical fantasy novel.
Yeah.
You know, it uses Caribbean voodoo lore and stuff like that. So for me, it's one I've always wanted to read because Karen Lord has only written 2 novels, people. And you know what? All the Best Possible Worlds was brilliant!
Okay.
In any case... Recommend some novels for us that you think we should actually tackle.
Yeah.
And then maybe come on the show with us.
And maybe come on the show. And this is something I'm actually going to do is I'm going to start reaching out to people in the podcast community and just saying, what do you want to read? Or what's your favorite thing? And then I'm just going to throw that on the list and then they can join us to guest host.
Exactly. I mean, because the reality is we we know what we like, but at the same time, sometimes it's important to branch out, and it's sometimes important to get a little bit out of the comfort zone. Scott.
Yeah.
This is the fun part, readers, is I'm actually the more multifaceted reader. You would never guess it because of how much of a book curmudgeon I am.
Yeah.
Where he's Mr. I like my fantasy and my cyberpunk.
Well, I like my dark fantasy and I like my cyberpunk and I like my weird urban fantasy, but as long as there are no disaffected chicks with bladed weapons and tattoos in them.
So you can't read Patricia Briggs.
Oh, there's a whole section at the bookstore I can't read.
Whereas...
And it's really easy to spot because the subgenre is also the cover design.
See... You would not fare well at a UK bookstore because the section's actually called Dark Fantasy. Yeah. It is a section you can't go into. I go into it so I can have a couple lols, but, you know, yeah. You can't.
UK book sections are kind of interesting in how they label things. There's definitely... there's a few bookstores that have the books about Nazis are just called mid-century oddities.
Yep. I mean, Scott, as a vocacious reader, you know, he likes... he's very picky about what he likes, whereas I, for example, read massive piles of YA, regardless of what it actually is. And I'm really not picky about genre. I've never really been picky about what I read, because as long as the story interests me, I'm generally okay. This is also why I finish every book I read. I'm not the type of person to, after one chapter, chuck it out the window. The only book I ever did that to was House of Leaves, and that one kind of earned it. Mm-hmm. Sorry to everyone who likes House of Leaves. But yeah, so next we're reading, well, one more reminder, South of the Border, West of the Sun by Haruki Murakami. The translation is by Peter Gabriel.
The guy from Genesis?
His name is Peter Gabriel.
The guy from Genesis.
It's not the guy from Genesis. Wait, maybe it's not Peter Gabriel. I have to go look at my book, people. in any case, it is about a time-traveling jazz bar and a woman who has a wooden leg and a man who is trying to restructure his life. Haruki Murakami, for those who have never experienced him before, he is a difficult read. I am not going to sugarcoat that in any way, shape, or form.
It is, his stuff is weird, and we may have picked the least accessible. No, not the least, but...
It's one of the more accessible.
There is a more accessible one that you have probably seen some guy with horn-rimmed glasses reading on a bus.
Called Norwegian Wood.
And Norwegian Wood is wonderful, but everyone reads Norwegian Wood, so we have to be different.
Well, and not just that. Scott and I don't think wanted to torment people with some of the more difficult novels that he's written, such as Kafka on the Shore.
That said,
and...
it is more accessible than... some of my favorites of his, and definitely Sam's favorite.
My favorite is called Hardboiled Wonderland at the End of the World, and it is the most brilliant novel ever written. I wrote my own dissertation on it. It's in the York University catalog. You can read it if you want.
Once they make their catalog more digital, which may happen, maybe, someday.
In any case.
If not, Sam has a copy. I may just post it.
Please don't. I'm embarrassed still by it.
Okay.
Because I was when I was not a very good writer.
All right, but yes.
Please catch us next time. We're also going to add Astro, so we're going to might have some cool stuff out of that, too.
Yeah, if you think we're cool and just are shouting at your MP3 player all the time while you're listening to us, you're probably someone who should be on the show just regularly. I'm not saying when I say permanent, I'm not saying permanent, but 3 out of 4 would be nice.
And like I tell Scott, I love him dearly. There is some books I will not touch with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
Like the one you guys read before this one.
Well, that was probably a very good choice.
I know. So we'll catch you next time. And happy reading.
Happy reading.
Backseat Book Club is a Backseat production. Visit BackseatProducers.com for more shows. Join the discussion and make suggestions for books on Goodreads.com. Music by Kevin MacLeod.